gotta see this.
Hi everybody, and welcome to the Antifada. I am Sean. This is a solo ep today, but I've got a great guest, a returning guest, a guest that you all know and love. That is, of course, Ted Reese. Ted, welcome back to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me on again. I can't believe it's a year and a half already since we last spoke.
I know, and in that subsequent time, the global capitalist economy has done some stuff. Geopolitics have done some stuff. And you've done some stuff, too, in that you wrote a brand new book, which is actually available right now, if I'm not mistaken, called Abundant Material Wealth for All, Manifesto for the Coming World Socialist Revolution. When I saw that this was coming out, well, you informed me that the book was coming out, and you asked me to blurb it, which was really, really nice. And then I saw it was coming out, and then I read the book. I was super hyped to have you back on. So thanks again for coming.
No problem, and thanks for having me on again. And hearing you read out the title of the book, that's quite nice to hear. It's the first time I've heard anyone read it out.
Oh,
I launched it about 4 weeks ago.
Nice.
And I'm going to put up, so it's available on Amazon in paperback, and I'm going to put out a free PDF this week as well.
Beautiful. So by the time this episode comes out, and obviously we can link to the book, people can have access it. And if they want to help support your work, and you've written several books at this point in time, they can also go to Amazon. So all those links will be in the show description. I think for today, Ted, let's catch up on what's happened in this last year and a half, which flew by so much. We had you on to talk about your reinterpretation or revival of Heinrich Grossman's critique of political economy, but especially his crisis theory, the breakdown theory. So what has happened over the last 18 months in the global capitalist economy? Are you more or less convinced that we're all suffering from very acute crisis tendencies at the moment?
Yeah, I'm more convinced than ever. I mean, the main thing to look at is this financial bubble, which is just reaching the craziest levels we've ever seen. Obviously, it's been labeled the everything bubble.
Yeah.
In some quarters, because it really encompasses and engulfs every asset class for the first time ever. That's been the case for over a decade now, really. And it did start to, you know, people were saying the everything bubble is crashing in 2022. And it did deflate by 20-25% or so, but it's now reached new highs again. So they managed to sort of, the economy managed to turn a corner and reinflate this bubble. And what we're seeing is this ridiculous concentration of value on the stock market into not just the Magnificent Seven in terms of the big tech companies that are dominating the stock market, but really it's only two or three of them that are actually growing in value and leaving almost the entirety of the rest of the stock, the S&P 500 behind. Mm-hmm. So we're really seeing a real stagnation or flatlining in the value of the rest of the S&P 500, whereas, NVIDIA and Meta are pulling away, and they're basically the only two attracting any new growth or any new value. And it's just a matter of time before that crashes, and it has started to go down a little bit in the last couple of weeks. So it's kind of like we're at a point now where I don't know if it's going to keep crashing or if it's going to, you know, go back up again for a little while. But it's on a knife edge, honestly.
There's been incredible means that the global capitalist class has cycled through the American financial system and fiscal and monetary system specifically, incredible lengths that they've gone to try to manage this particular crisis. I think one of the new things in the last year and a half, or maybe the interest rates were rising a year and a half ago when you came on the show, was there was an attempt, of course, to sop up a lot of this excess money floating around. And it appears as though, or at least the stenographers of power in places like the New York Times, Financial Times, Wall Street Journal, seem to feel as though they've managed to find that elusive soft landing, despite baseline interest rates being up around 7 or 8%. So what do you attribute this to? Is this, how has the bubble been able to maintain itself in spite of this?
It's just a case of sort of using all the tools that of at their disposal in terms of government debt and the central bank stepping in and intervening with its bailout programs. You know, it's got the reverse repo fund, for example, where banks can borrow from another fund that has been opened up by the central bank to bail out banks, but that fund is running down now. Basically every time there's a new crisis, that they come up with some new fund to bail out the banks. And so they've been using the reverse repo fund, and they had another one, the name of it escapes me because there's been so many, but but yeah, they'll step in with the various instruments and, you know, flood the market with debt, and that will basically soften the blow for a while. What's really happening is they're picking their winners, sort of thing, where they're trying to make sure the biggest banks don't fail, and they're letting some of the smaller ones go bankrupt, because they can't just infinitely print money and bail out everyone. So if you look at the broader pattern, between the year 2000 and the year 2017, 43% of the banking sector went bankrupt or disappeared.
Wow.
Either through mergers or bankruptcy. So, and that's just a staggering number, and we're already another 7 years on from that. I really need to update that stat if I can find it. It's not necessarily out there yet, but and then in 2022, the losses that the banking industry was making in the financial reports made by the Federal Reserve indicated that the losses were staggeringly higher than they were in 2008, and we all know how bad 2008 was.
Of course.
So, it, like I say, almost half of the banking industry was wiped out effectively after 2008. And yeah, we're several years on, and with the fall in inflation, that should have seen a new round of mergers and acquisitions, and it has. So it'll be interesting to see. I haven't written any updates on the mergers and acquisitions lately. I haven't had time to look into it closely enough, but there has been a massive round of mergers and acquisitions in the last 6 months after that fall in inflation, which enabled that. So the thing I've been concentrating on recently is talking about this sort of tendency towards a final merger. Because with every crisis, you get this acceleration of mergers. And one of the sort of little factoids I've discovered since the last time I spoke to is that four of the last seven major merger and acquisition waves has taken place in the past 35 years.
Wow.
And the seven overall have taken place in the last 130 years. So you can see that this tendency is acceleration.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Fascinating. To bring this into out of the ethereal realm of the financial economy and into the real world economy, it seems as though a lot of the more general economic and social crisis that we're seeing right now is taking its form of appearance globally in terms of geopolitics, but also in the workshop of the world. Because if you've read the news reports, there is a huge kerfuffle between the ruling class in the United States and the Chinese ruling party now about industrial production in China, especially fears of dumping very high value-added goods like solar panels and electric cars, which are made incredibly cheap in China. There's a real fear now of overcapacity, of overaccumulation, of overabundance of goods, and what this might mean geopolitically. So where does that fit into this larger story?
Yeah, I mean, there's a split in the ruling class where one part of the ruling class is against decoupling from China, as to use the language that they use. Yeah. And then there's the other part of the ruling class, which seems to be the part that has more of a control on the state. I don't know if that's because it's coming from weapons manufacturers or you know, people who are sort of have more of an interest in starting a war with China, or it's domestic capitalists based in the US who want you know, that investment going to the companies that are based in the US rather than that investment being shipped overseas and invested in China. So, yeah, this is a manifestation of crisis conditions where there's sort of like diminishing pools of profit, essentially. And so competition over that diminishing pool of profit intensifies and you get these splits in the ruling class. You know, if you've got investments in China, you don't want to pull them out just because other capitalists based in the US are telling you to.
Right.
Because it's not in your immediate interests. Maybe that'll change if with the next recession, those investments in China are no longer profitable. Or capitalists in China squeeze, you know, are able to sort of snap up those investments or provide alternatives that, you know, suit the Chinese economy more favorably. So it's kind of like an open question at the moment. Mm.
And there's been a realization, it seems like, from like the various fractions of the American ruling class, at least, and the European, Western European ruling class, too, that, you know, globalization has led to a point where, you know, despite some decent profits, or at least a ruling class that's able to continually reproduce itself, let's just say, in the developed capitalist world, that the actual in the realm of the realm of production and the realm like the substratum of capital, the material substratum, there are incredible problems of national production. And I'm thinking specifically, of course, during the COVID crisis, when the American working class and ruling class both realized at the same time that we don't have the capacity to make many of the things that within a nationally bounded, crisis-ridden system are necessary in order to keep people alive. You're seeing a very similar thing now with the attempt to reshore, to renationalize, or even to friendshore a lot of production, that it's seeming incapable for, say, the United States to both act as the purveyor of a working class consumer of last resort on the one hand, but also a suitable field for investment of capital with a sufficient rate of profitability. You know what I mean? That seems to be what a lot of the political calculus and a lot of the political crisis in the United States is about right now.
Yeah, and the dependency on China for even including military software and equipment that the US uses that they essentially purchase or make in China and then import, you know, that dependency is very high. So you would have thought that that would take 10, 20 years to sort of wean off or transition from. And it's just a massive barrier, really, to this sort of fantasy of re-nationalizing, that's not really the right word, but sort of
reshoring, I guess, or
reshoring, yeah, or re-industrializing, but any re-industrializing, you know, there has been instances of re-industrializing where it has become cheaper and more profitable to reshore. But you're not doing that with a lot of employment coming out of it.
Exactly.
Because we're in the age of automation now. You know, we're increasingly in the age of automation. And any factories that are being built in the US that wouldn't have been built in the US in the previous period, they're not generally speaking going to be big employers. And that causes its own problem. So essentially, it causes the problem of not having a lot of labor and labor time to exploit. And then on the surface level or secondary effect of that is that, you know, you're not boosting the sort of purchasing power of the worker or the tax intake from the general population. So right. the tax base is suffering even with that sort of trend reemerging. So, yeah, like I've said many times, I do think capitalism is starting to come up against, you know, its ultimate limits because of these intractable problems.
And this is something that you lay out, I think, in, dare I say, magisterial form in your book. But before we get to the book, and we're going to talk about your modest 12-point plan for abundant material wealth for all, let's touch base with the United Kingdom, because that is, of course, where you're from. People can tell that you're from there. What's going on with the UK economy? Like every time I look, every time something comes up on the Financial Times or the New York Times or whatever, I'm always looking at more and more dire economic news. So what are things like over there, maybe in your own experience, but more generally?
Yeah, it feels so dead here, honestly. It just feels like we are just in sort of, it's not been freefall, but it's been this steady decline and just like epic stagnation, where if you look at the GDP growth stats and one quarter it's grown by 0.1%, and the next quarter it's declined by 0.1%, and it's sort of like going between those two sort of things, and yeah, going absolutely nowhere. And you know, we keep getting the government sort of basically trying to deal with this by cutting taxes. You know, the very traditional British way of solving these problems is, sure, oh, we'll cut taxes and that will get the economy going because people will have more money to spend either in investment or just general consumption. But the problem is you're basically destroying what's left of a very already very weak tax base. Mm. And that's actually causing panic when that sort of thing is being announced. So we had Liz Truss.
Yes, that was a quick premiership, wasn't it?
Yeah, very briefly. She announced a plan to, you know, quite drastically cut taxes, and it spooked the markets and it brought her down. But now the Conservative government now is basically doing the same thing, but because it's sort of like in the old hands of the sort of more traditional or competent wing of the Tory party, for some reason it hasn't spooked the markets as much. So I don't know if it's just a case of they literally don't have any other option, because if they don't do it, you know, it's not going to encourage any investment anyway. And the economy's either stagnating or you know, we did have a recession. We had 6 months of negative growth, and then we had one quarter, you know, the last quarter we did have growth, but again it was something like 0.1-0.2%. So yeah, things are pretty dire,
and obviously that's reflected in employment. And but at the same time too, there's very much like a rentier economy that's centered in London. And a lot of financial flows still, despite their best efforts, are running through the city of London. So you've got this incredible mixture, it seems like, of underemployment and unemployment and declining living standards and purchasing power on the one hand, but then like a London property market that is completely inflated and absurd at the same time.
Yeah, so when we had the pandemic and they bailed out companies here and banks here, and they basically, you know, printed loads of money and just gave it to rich people, and rich people didn't have anything else to do with it but buy housing assets, right, or property assets, and that had its own inflationary effect. It was just, but it was sold to the public on, you know, you've got some money, we're giving everyone some money, but most of that money, so like obviously a lot of people thought, oh well, that's good of the government to do that, and fine, like it had to do something, but most of that money went to rich people who didn't have anything else to invest it in but property. So we've seen the housing, you know, a lot of people thought that period was going to generate a housing crash, which would bring housing prices down and enable more first-time buyers to buy their first property. But that didn't happen. Prices went up even faster than they had in the previous period. So in terms of people being able to get on with their lives, it's just got worse.
Pretty good if you're like a legacy pensioner who like has had, maybe they had an old council estate home that was privatized in the 1980s, and they're in their 70s or 80s now and enjoying their golden years, and the value, quote unquote, of their house has gone up by 20 times over the last 30 years or so. But not so good if you're a young person trying to get a job in like the only place that there's really decent jobs left, which is London.
Yeah, exactly. And speaking of pensions, those were bailed out in Britain. The Bank of England was reversing some of the money printing policies and trying to sort of wind down its own debt. But during, I think it was 2022, they had to bail out the pension funds in this country. And they said if they hadn't done that, that it would have gone bust. So,
imagine that.
And yeah,
that would have been a nightmare. Well, we're going to transition to talking about the book, but I think one of the things I've been focusing on other things besides the critique of political economy for a while, which is why I was interested in having you back on to update and talk about the book or whatever. But like, I get the sense that there's this humongous, like world spanning kluge of like all these different various state measures and policies, which right now, again, the epicenter of that is the United States and China, I suppose. It appears as though, like you were saying, with, you know, markets refusing to fall, we've got crises like the commercial real estate market here in New York City and the rest of the country, which I've been watching for the last year and a half, ever since the pandemic, and saying, how is it possible that these balls are still up in the air? How is all this still being juggled? How has this not led to a series of rapid devaluations and bankruptcies? And it hasn't, which is interesting in and of itself, actually, shows the massive amount of social power and political and state power necessary to keep this up. It's actually, in a sense, quote unquote, working, right? But I get the sense that it's going to, the beginning of the final crisis or the beginning of this next acute crisis that we're going into is going to take the form of appearance of geopolitics. It's going to appear like a loss of faith in American hegemony and dominance. It's going to look like an investor reaction to the impending loss of Ukraine in the war, which probably in the next 6 to 12 months will probably be a fait accompli. It seems like the Biden administration and the Rishi Sunak administration are hoping to get Ukraine just to survive past the American election day, and then different choices could be made. But it doesn't look like that's necessarily going to be a possibility. So what do you think? Like, am I on the right track here? Will it look like a political crisis that sets off like the actual economic crisis? Or do you think that markets might impose themselves before that? Or is it going to happen at the same time? I don't know.
I mean, it could happen at the same time, or either of those things could be the trigger or ultimately the manifestation of the economic crisis. Because, for example, and this is the one I've been sort of expecting, like with the everything bubble, it's a case of how long can they inflate it for via sort of like some instances of devaluation that sort of enable a new round of reinflation of that bubble. But at some point, you know, you'd expect the Republican Party is already sort of, you know, avidly trying to lower the debt ceiling and has been trying to do that, or at least large sections of the Republican Party has been trying to do that for a long time. So when they, at some point, I would expect them to have the political power to be able to do that. So far, they haven't had that. But at some point, the sort of the inability of the Democrats or the sort of slightly more moderate wing of the Republican Party to stop this sort of debt spiral is going to manifest in a you know, loss of faith in them politically, and they're going to lose their political power. And the sections of the ruling class who want this debt ceiling to come down are going to win out, basically. Whether that's through, you know, elections, I suppose it probably will be. I mean, it is hard to tell because it didn't happen when Trump was president last time.
Yeah.
Even though he's been banging on about doing that, and his supporters have been banging on about doing that, because essentially they don't want to spend that money on whatever it is that isn't going to benefit their bottom line. So whatever it is they're invested in, if that money is being spent by the state on something that could be subsidizing them,
right?
They're not interested in it. So at some point that has to come to a head, that whole situation with the debt ceiling. So it will look like, to most people, it will look like a political thing, and people will curse the Republicans, or they'll curse the MAGA movement. Or
they'll
whatever.
Curse the Democrats for having let it go on so long. It'll turn into a partisan fight.
Well, yeah, and you know, sections will peel off in different directions, and you know, some of them might, and there's evidence for this, that some of the right wing of the Democrats are moving towards the Republican party for this very reason, or you know, this being one of the reasons.
Part of a broader realignment of American politics that's what we're seeing right now. For example, like the Republican neocons have just been sort of subsumed into the Democratic Party now. But I think that's very plausible, imagining this taking the form of appearance of a political crisis, because it is a very real political crisis. And it feels like the populist forces certainly aren't really maybe understand the importance of the string of that sweater that they're pulling on right now. And yeah, when the whole thing unravels, there might be some buyer's remorse there, but we'll see. In the meantime, let's get to your book. I want to start with like a cool little tidbit here. And I've heard people make this argument before, but you make it really interestingly, and I think tantalizingly in the book. In the book, Abundant Material Wealth for All, you argue that, quote, money is dying a natural death. We just spent all this time talking about the importance of finance and then debt and talking about the way that that rockets and is cycled around the globe into production, but sometimes not into production. It's fascinating to argue, as you do through statistics and through analysis and critique, that money is dying a natural death. What do you mean by that?
I mean, my whole argument really is starting to say that capitalism is dying a natural death. Mm-hmm. So in historical terms, in terms of its natural lifespan. So if you take money, for instance, the US dollar has lost about 97% of its purchasing power since 1913. Most of that has happened since the 1970s, mm-hmm. when, you know, the computing revolution really took off and spurred an exponential increase in productive capacity and output. Britain has, the British pound sterling has seen the same thing. That's even more devalued than the US dollar. The number of currencies in existence is down to a dwindling few historically. Right. I think only 20% of the currencies that were in existence, you know, 300 years ago are still in existence today. That might not be exactly right. I'd have to.
I read check, something like that in your book.
Yeah, it's something like that. Anyway, yeah. but yeah, like so, every currency that remains, the few that remain, they've all been massively devalued, and this is just a, you know, the right wing libertarians and the like will say this is the outcome of central bank policy and all this sort of thing.
Fiat currency.
Yeah, but it's just a manifestation of expanded production that's been brought about by the demands of capital accumulation and innovation and, you know, the natural tendency for us as a species as well to innovate and find ways of producing more, whether that be for labor saving purposes or life enhancing purposes, whatever it is. The more we produce, the more commodities are devalued, and that goes for money as well. Money is also a commodity.
Right. And as the universal equivalent too, there, you know, it is connected to these epochal rises in productivity that we've seen over the last 100, 200 years.
Yes, exactly. And it's funny because this is, you know, it's not what I just said is not really disputed by any.
Right. Even bourgeois economists. Yeah.
By anyone from any economic background or tendency, no one's going to argue that commodities are devalued when we, you know, they tend to devalue when we produce them in greater amounts in less time. No one argues against that yet.
They see the line declining. They see the line go down, but they don't actually take the lesson from that, which is that there's some sort of tendential process that's happening, which, as we argue, as Marxists, is like undermining the actual ability of capital to reproduce itself.
Yeah. So I think like the upshot of this is that we need to replace money. So, and, you know, we need to replace money. We need to replace capitalism. It's served its purpose historically. It is exhausted historically. What do we do? So we have to look at the tendencies, the empirical data and the tendencies, and see what is happening. And like I say, so we're moving towards this tendency towards ever greater mergers, which means we're logically and historically moving towards a final merger.
One capital.
Sorry?
We would be facing one capital. There would be a single capital right at the very end.
Yeah.
It's what the final merger means, right?
Yeah, and you know, the key thing to realize or grasp is that a total monopoly cannot be privately owned, mm-hmm. because there's no ownership, there's no exchange of ownership to be had in that scenario. So it has to be publicly owned. But the trouble is convincing people that there has to be this tendency towards mergers. You know, a lot of people just see it and they think it's an agenda.
Right, right. They think it's a failure of government intervention, which is a very, which is a relatively new idea for capitalism, right? It's like from the progressive era. And there's so many ways in which the state, especially in the United States, and I'm sure the UK too, tries to pose various policies as a counter tendency to this and tries to facilitate like capital creation through smaller enterprises, often extremely subsidized, in order to keep a sort of quasi competition going, but under the auspices of massive state intervention.
Yeah, and you do see when we get a recovery from a recession, we do get sort of a weaker decentralizing tendency where bits of capital break off and form new capitals independently, you know, but basically through startups. But, you know, a lot of the time, those are either spin-offs from state R&D, which is subsidized by the state, obviously, or they are sort of connected to rich families. So there's not a lot more outside of that. But then, you know, at some point those companies, these startups, see their rates of profit fall, or they become too successful for their own good in terms of they have to sell up, they have to be bought up by you know, larger monopolies, or subsumed by larger monopolies in order to either because they need it financially in able to move forward to the next stage of their development, or because they don't have the money otherwise. So in the US, for example, I can't remember the exact years, but we've seen a, you know, it's all outlined in the book at the start of the book where I list all of the empirical economic trends, but the number of startups as a share of the US economy has tended to decline as well. And again, at an accelerating rate. It's only in the last period that I looked at, it had fallen from 16% to 8%.
Massive.
I think it was something like from 1990 to 2010 or something like that. So quite stark again. And yeah, like all I can say is to people who sort of think that this is an agenda rather than a natural manifestation of historical conditions and capital accumulation itself, the demands of capital accumulation, all I can say is, you know, what I just said, like none of us disagree on this fact that devaluation is a natural tendency over time as productive capacity rises. I think the problem is that, you know, possibly as Marxists as well, we've underestimated the size of what some of us call the semi-proletariat. So after the 70s, when a lot of companies were re-privatized, so in Britain, we obviously had a lot of manufacturing industry nationalized. It was privatized. And one of the ways they did that was to promise the workers who worked in those various companies and industries a decent amount of shares in the company at knockdown rates, sort of thing. It wasn't long before the workers just had to sell those shares, like a lot of the time.
Like the Soviet Union, right? Like 1991.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, but this created a new layer of it's not necessarily petty bourgeoisie, but a semi-proletarian layer, basically. And even now, this layer is massive because I don't know if you've seen, but there's been lots of headlines about a whole generation of investors and this sort of thing, where basically, like, because it's so accessible, like loads and loads of people are online investing in penny stocks.
So if
you look at every generation over the last four decades or five decades, a bigger share of each generation is becoming investors. But then when you look closer, the amount of time that they invest for, or the amount of time they hold onto their investment for, is declining rapidly. So in 1980, British shareholders were holding on to their shares for nearly 10 years. But last year, the average had fallen to below a year.
Okay.
So you have this sort of dialectical sort of thing going on where more people are becoming shareholders, but they're holding on to their shares for less and less time.
Interesting.
So what we're seeing really is what we saw was a massive upswing in the semi-proletarian layer.
And these are semi-proletarian, you say, because their reproduction isn't solely through the sale of their labor power. They also have some stake in equities, yeah. Bonds, pension
exactly.
funds.
Exactly. They have some small shareholdings, and they're trying to use the stock market as a secondary source of income.
Right.
But this is dwindling. So even though we've been tending towards seeing a greater proportion of the working class being semi-proletarian, but we're now on the verge, I think, of that coming to a crashing halt and seeing a massive wave of re-proletarianization,
right,
or a full proletarianization, where that layer, probably, you know, a very large proportion of that layer is going to be re-proletarianized and become wholly dependent on selling their labor power. But it also might be a large wave of lumpenization.
Yeah. As existing proletarians now face this intensifying competition from previously semi-proletarianized individuals.
Yes, good point.
Yeah, that's fascinating, because if you look at the great epochal world historical shifts in politics, as we've seen them over the last 150 years or so, many of them are accompanied by like a massive wave of proletarianization. Massive movements from the countryside into the cities, and all of the attendant social and economic and political disruption that takes. I mean, that's obviously part of the story of 1905 and 1917 in Russia. So it's fascinating to imagine, on the cusp of, as you argue, this great breakdown, the ways in which everyday politics and life might change if all of a sudden we're seeing a process like 1905 or 1917 in Russia, but under very, very different modern or postmodern conditions. And that's really the point of your book, right? Because your book isn't merely a diagnosis of all the symptoms that, you know, we spoke about today, but we also spoke about 18 months ago. It is also a political project, and it's a call to arms. So where does, connect the political goals of socialism to all the sort of crisis tendencies that we've been talking about? Where do you land on that in the book?
So in terms of the title, I think it's important to state why I called it Abundant Material Wealth for All, because I think there's probably a good argument to say you shouldn't call it that, because you're promising a lot. But I think there's obviously we wouldn't be able to deliver that quickly, especially if you get isolated revolutions and whatever. But I think it's important for people to sort of, there's so many reasons why I called it this, because
one I would just say that I'm imputing to you, but I think this is true, is that so much of socialist and communist and anarchist rhetoric matches the rhetoric of the ruling class right now, and being deeply pessimistic, deeply Malthusian as well, and deeply misanthropic, it seems like.
This is why I write books, because I'm better at articulating through the written word. But there's this historical trend towards abundance for all. Like, we've seen it during capitalism, where even though some of the more important things like housing and healthcare has become more expensive, our ability to produce cheap commodities has gone through the roof in the last 20, 30, 40 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can not have a very good standard of living, but you can still have like access to all these technological commodities and do something creative with it, and so on and so forth. So there is this actual historical tendency, like we say, of, you know, the devaluation of commodities, which makes them more accessible. So we should recognize that there is this actual tendency towards abundant material wealth for all to start with. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people have experienced that, right? They've experienced an increase in their living standards just because things have got cheaper. So when their living standards start to decline, and even those sort of positives start to disappear, I think it's really important for us to say, look, we can get back on track.
Right.
But we're going to have to change the system, because we've exhausted the old system's ability to reach that potential. And one of the other, and, you know, Because if you were doing well during capitalism, even like, because I think we overestimate how many people are actually capitalists, like properly, like big bourgeoisie capitalists. So if, you know, I think a big layer of the sort of the semi-proletariat that I've talked about have been quite well off during the last 40 years. And if we're giving the impression, or they have the impression, that we just want to take everything away from them, sort of thing, then we're not doing ourselves any favours. So I think we also want to, you know, appeal not just to the existing working class, but to the layers that are being re-proletarianized, because that's really the decisive shift that, you know, this sort of tipping point in the balance of class forces that is now starting to tip back the other way. We have to have a political solution for uniting those different layers that are sort of all being re-proletarianized or merge, you know, because we are seeing, as well as a final merger of corporations and monopolies, we're seeing that is also a manifestation of a final merger of the of classes, effectively. So you have a tendency towards the masses being proletarianized, but it's going to happen very suddenly, because, as I say, the tendency has really been semi-proletarianization over the last 40-50 years, and in this funny dialectical way where more people are becoming semi-proletarian, but their investments are dwindling at the same time. So
it's a tendency leading to its own dissolution.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's really important to recognize that and not just sort of think in this sort of way where, you know, there's this sort of fixed working class that's a fixed proportion of the population that sort of just has to be directed in crisis conditions. I think you have to be more flexible and forward thinking than that.
Interesting. And it's interesting to look at, say, like Western politics through that lens, because, you know, you could argue that, you know, based on your theory, that a lot of the right-wing populism that we're seeing right now are semi-proletarians reacting to the real downturn in their lives and attempting to hold on through a retrograde politics, through a backwards-looking politics, to that semi-proletarian existence, which in more and more cases cannot be reproduced.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And that's sort of the point I was trying to make. And, you know, it's probably a natural reaction, right? Like you've been making your money in this way. You're able to support your family in this way, and you don't want to lose that source of income. And so probably there is a natural instinct to look towards right wing libertarianism, where it's, you know, the reaction is, I'm being taxed too much.
I'm being regulated too much. The central bank is using funny money to take away my profits, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, because they, you know, a lot of right-wing libertarians, you know, they're not even really capitalists. They're just, you know, small investors. They've got a small stake in a bunch of companies.
Right.
And their pensions are dependent on, you know, the bank investing in the stock market as well and that sort of thing.
But these people are ultimately, as you argue, these people are ultimately, as they re-enter the class, they're ultimately people that need to be reached. So the subtitle of your book is Manifesto for the Coming World Socialist Revolution. So we've already talked about in what sense it's coming, I think very clearly, right? This acute crisis that we're going through right now, which will only get more acute, and the re-proletarianization of large sectors of the semi-proletariat. How do we help the process of the coming world socialist revolution along?
I mean, that's the question, isn't it?
That's the question, yeah.
because it, you know, I'm saying that world socialism is essentially becoming an economic necessity for the first time. What I'm not saying is that there's a set date, time and place when it's going to start and finish.
Right.
That bit depends, largely on us. You know, if our reaction to the crisis is just to do nothing, then things will just get worse and worse. And you'll just have this sort of threadbare capitalism with almost everyone living in impoverished conditions and so on and so forth. Mm. So it demands a political solution. And that's, you know, I still think that demands a vanguard party that, you know, agitates for a socialist state and uses this sort of this is why I think, you know, I think parties should have a manifesto with this as their title, because then you're changing the conversation that is usually had about what a Communist Party is. And you're setting out long-term aims and you're making sense, you're taking a sensible approach, an incentivizing approach. One of the other things I put in there is that we should expropriate the last capitalist through compensation.
Similar to the Maoists in the 1950s, right? They pensioned they pensioned out the large sections of the capitalist class.
Yeah, because that will have the effect of, you know, fostering splits. I'm not saying it's going to be a total success and, you know, help to avoid all forms of civil war. I'm not that deluded or idealistic, but it can reduce the amount of social conflict having that sort of policy. And you know that, yeah, like I say, that can foster splits in the ruling class. It can incentivize capitulation and that sort of thing. So I've sort of put this mix of things together where, you know, for example, cancel all mortgages, keep the houses that you have, because we can build new ones and create incentives for people to move into new housing, and then the old housing becomes obsolete or whatever, rather than have this sort of like ultra left view where what we're going to do is expropriate everyone without compensation. We're going to take all their houses
and then redistribute them through some sort of what kind of process, collective communal process.
Yeah. And it's just, it's impractical for one thing. It's unenforceable to do it that swiftly. So you have to take this sort of like middle approach, I suppose. I hate using that sort of language. I'm going to be labeled a centrist.
Well, but if we're looking at a mass politics, right. It's kind of like a lump in, it's like a lump in politics to argue for like complete expropriation and then redistribution through a state or through a commune thing. When if the people that we're trying to reach ultimately are these reproletarianized masses, some of whom rent a home and many of whom own a home, if you're trying to get as many people together for the socialist project, there's something I think attractive and intuitive about people having their mortgages canceled and being able to remain where it is that they have families and friends and jobs and all that. It seems very practical.
Yeah, exactly. And so like I say, I think like we want sensible policies that basically quell counter-revolutionary instincts, because we've got a hell of a task on. You know what I'm talking about is just the scale of it.
It's something that's never been done in world history. It would be the most difficult and satisfying and tumultuous and beautiful thing that humanity has ever tried to do together. Let me read as we kind of wind down a little bit, and I'm going to encourage people to get your book. We have the Abundant Material Wealth for All 12-point plan. So people know exactly what you're talking about. And this would be inscribed on the banners, as you imagine it, of like revived national communist and socialist parties around the globe, right? So number one, sovereignty of the people and nation. Number two, public ownership of production and services, continually falling prices and rising economic independence for all. Three, a clean industrial energy and farming revolution that is actually clean. Four, full employment, including earn as you learn trainee schemes. Five, continually reduced working week and retirement age, revitalizing independent creativity and craftsmanship. That one appeals to me. Abolish exploitation and economic crises, universal education, health, social, and childcare, free at the point of access, and low-cost, highly accessible public transport. Also a big fan. Cancel all mortgages and personal debt, low rent, high-quality housing for all, a new democratic constitution written by the people enshrining the rights of humanity, a new space program, and generalized off-world tourism. Hell yeah. And then number 12, maybe my favorite, is build great monuments to the working class.
There you have it.
There you have it.
I think that and the purpose of laying it out like that is to maximize the appeal that we have, appeal to the broadest possible layer, because as I say, we're not just appealing to the existing working class and the existing activist base. We have to appeal to the broad masses in a way that's going to sort of unfold as a process.
Now, here's a couple of, I don't want to spend too much time like going through criticisms and critiques, but the first thing I would see, right, is you use people and not the working class. So this is like, there's a populist thrust to this, right? Why did you make that particular choice, and why too did was nation included in there, sovereignty of the people and nation?
Well, technically, we're not going to be workers. We're not going to be proletarians, technically, because we're not going to be exploited.
Right.
So, you know, you could use either. It's not a massive deal. But that's the reason why I chose that word, almost on a technicality. It's a bit of a difficult one, really. And also, again, because I don't want to alienate people who probably are becoming working class but don't think of themselves as working class. On the sovereignty of the nation and people, the world revolution is going to have to start somewhere in one nation. Mm. Somewhere one nation is going to be the first place to have a revolution, by definition, because they're not maybe you get two or three at the same time, but I doubt it.
Yeah,
like it's
not a big conspiracy where like all like secret cadres in every single nation can all like press the revolution button at the same time, right?
No, exactly. So I think, you know, you are going to have to appeal to people in your nation. And, you know, a communist international is made up of nations. Further down the line, we might start to think of nations as obsolete, you know, once the whole world is socialist. But we can't jump the gun on that. We can't sort of go into our agitational meetings and go, we need to abolish the nation. We need to start, you know, all this stuff.
Yeah.
One step at a time.
Maybe there's a way that you could begin like the denationalization process. And I'm just thinking of like the Trotskyist call in the 1930s and 1940s for like within a reinvigorated Fourth International, not having like a Communist Party of the United States, but instead having a Communist Party of North America. And then like immediately then in the process of fighting for internationalism, you're already creating like the auspices for, you know, transnational cooperation between working classes and parties.
Yeah, that's a possibility. I'm not dogmatic on any of this stuff.
Yeah, that's what I like about your book. That's what I like about all of your work. I liked it about the Grossman piece, Grossman book that we talked about last time. And I like it about this too. I think, you know, I think we can like, there's plenty of critiques, but this isn't the place for it. I think maybe we could come back and like do like a Q&A thing would be really fun in like a month or two. But I think in the meantime, people should take this book seriously because it's like, it's a very clarifying text. It's very clarifying about where we are. And it's also very clarifying about where we need to be and how to get there. So I think that having a 12-point program that's really basic and intuitive, I think is a very powerful thing and exactly the kind of thing we need right now.
I'm glad that you think that, and it's obviously reassuring to hear. And yeah, like I say, it is a draft, but it's it's a sort of a foundation to work from. And like we've sort of discussed, it's kind of like the most appealing possible. I've tried to make it the most appealing possible to the most people possible.
Yeah, based on the actual conditions that exist right now and the political consciousness that exists right now.
Because there's so much that we can fall out on about and that we do fall out about. But we can't fix all those things, unfortunately. And we do have to take it one day at a time. And we have to find a central rallying point around which we can unite. And that's what I've attempted to put together.
Well, again, incredible use of empirical data, a really good kind of expanding of your theses from the Grossman book, a really great call to arms, and I think a really good place to start really important discussions about what we actually mean when we talk about overcoming capital and changing the world. So, Ted, thanks again for coming on. I am serious about maybe coming back. We could do a fun little thing where we bounce some more of these ideas around in the coming months. But in the meantime, great job on this book, and we'll link it and we'll promote it. And I think that people should really check it out. So thanks so much, man.
Thanks very much again for having me on. And yeah, I look forward to doing that with you.
Awesome. Yeah. And thanks for allowing me to do a blurb for a book. It's the first time I ever did one. So I'm touched.
All right. Well, thanks for taking the time out to do it, to give it that preview read, mate.
No worries, man. My pleasure. All right. And we'll see you on the next one. I stay modest about it, she elaborated, ayy. This that great poupon, that Avion, that TED Talk. Watch my soul speak, you let the meds talk, ayy. If I kill a nigga, it won't be the alcohol. I'm the realest nigga after all. Bitch, be humble. Hold up, bitch.
sit down. Be humble. Sit down. Be humble. Bitch, sit down. Be humble. Sit down. Be humble. Sit down. Be humble. Sit down. Bitch, sit down. Little bitch, be humble. Sit down.